an ice navigator is an individual that has been specially trained to operate in the ice.
A new training program in Seward aims to prepare mariners for Arctic waters. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new exhibit tells the story of Anchorage's Native people.
Most people who live in Anchorage have no idea that there is an Indigenous population that has been here and continues to be here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan is stepping down from his post amid talk that he's planning a run for U.S. Senate. Republicans see incumbent Mark Begich's seat as one of the keys to taking control of Congress, and the race is already getting heated. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Sullivan announced his resignation to Governor Sean Parnell on Wednesday night, giving September 24th as his last day. According to Parnell's spokesperson, the governor will name an acting commissioner at that point while he looks for a permanent replacement. Sullivan has been a commissioner since 2010, and before that, he was the state's attorney general. In his resignation letter, he trumpeted his work in both positions. What Sullivan didn't mention is what he plans to do next. Governor Parnell didn't get into that either, though he did give Sullivan a blessing of sorts, saying he wishes him much success in the future. The expectation is that he's going to join the ranks of Republicans looking to take on Democrat Mark Begich. Here's Peter Goldberg, the state party chair.
Several candidates have already declared. Joe Miller made federal. Kathleen Tun. And most people seem to believe that Commissioner Dan Sullivan is going to join the race very soon.
Goldberg says that even though the field is getting crowded, he's still hoping to avoid a messy primary. That seat is one of a handful that Republicans need to win if they want a majority in the Senate. The Republican National Committee is sending a state director to set up shop this month, and its chair, Reince Priebus, plans to visit Alaska in October. Even though Sullivan isn't a household name, there are Republican leaders in Alaska and Washington, D.C. who think he could be a viable candidate for higher office. In addition to his time in the governor's cabinet, he also worked in the State Department during the Bush administration, and he served in Afghanistan as a lieutenant colonel in the Army as recently as last month. He couldn't be reached for comment for this story because he's traveling back from Japan on a state trip. Political watchers expect him to appeal to party moderates. That's the same wing that Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, who just held his campaign launch, might attract. Meanwhile, Joe Miller, a Tea Party candidate who challenged Lisa Murkowski in 2010, has marked himself as the more conservative candidate. Randy DeSoto, a spokesperson for Miller, says it's too early to say how Sullivan's entrance might affect race dynamics.
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate which candidate would benefit, you know, whether one gets in or gets out. We certainly want, you know, we feel that our message will attract those people who supported Joe in the past and will be appealing to others as well going forward.
There will be plenty of time to compete for voters. The Republican primary will be held August 19th, a full 11 months from now. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Recent federal and state focus on Alaska's role in Arctic Ocean shipping has raised concerns over regulation, safety, and oil spill response, among other issues. But one teaching institution in our state is already dealing with the most basic question, who's going to be driving the boats? As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, Seward's Alaska Vocational Technical Center plans to start the nation's first ice navigation training course next spring.
Obviously, we've rigged up this exercise to show you our ice capability because
we are standing on the bridge of a vessel close behind an ice-breaking ship, plowing through oil rigs locked in a frozen landscape. We can feel the rolling of the deck, see the golf ball-sized snowflakes pounding on the forecastle windows.
Yeah, because you're gonna hit that oil rig in a minute now, huh?
But wait, it's all virtual.
See the rudder is actually turning. That's a rudder angle right there. The clicking you hear is a...
And it's all part of a new course that AvTech is planning to offer next spring. Scott Hamilton heads AvTech's maritime department. He says the course uses ice navigation simulators to replicate the actual experience of operating a ship in Arctic conditions.
Our theme around here at AvTech is that the training we like to do is company, area, and vessel-specific training. You know, we can read the textbook, but the real reality is your ability to come in and conduct a vessel, many different types of ships, many different types of cargoes, it's best done safely in a ship simulator.
Hamilton is a former Alaska Marine Highway captain, and he knows what it takes to get mariner's certifications. He says competition from foreign shipping, especially tourism-related, is skyrocketing in the Arctic.
And we're not ready. And the Coast Guard understands that, but it's a huge challenge. Most of the traffic that's operating up here right now is foreign flag vessels and foreign flag crews.
In 2016, new International Marine Organization certification standards will kick in for Arctic ship operators. Mike Terminal is president of AvTech's Maritime Board and a working ship's captain and ice navigator. He's got 30 trips to Antarctica under his belt, and he says ice navigation is something that has to be experienced to be learned.
An ice navigator is an individual that has been specially trained to operate in the ice. You can be a captain on a container ship for 25 years and never go into ice once. That is something that the IMO and the United States Coast Guard has looked at very carefully these last couple of years, and they're going to be implementing rules and endorsements that will be coming out here shortly to make sure that mariners are properly trained when they're in Arctic waters.
Anything north of latitude 60 is considered the Arctic. That means most of Alaska, and the training can be used in all areas, for Cook Inlet oil rigs and Valdez Arm tanker traffic, for example. But the far north is a different story. North of the Arctic Circle, there are few aids to navigation. Floating and coastal aids are seasonal. Charts are not the most accurate, and the only real-time weather information comes from weather stations at Nome or Red Dog Mine. Navigators there need a specialized background. Mike Angove is the simulator engineer at AvTech. He says the simulators are Norwegian-built at a cost of $2.5 million.
They are the top of the line. They're the best in the world because they got the mathematics correct. It's what makes our simulator special compared to other simulators.
The school has put $1 million into them since acquiring the simulators, and it is looking for further support from the industry. They can be used by individuals, but they can handle groups of 18 at a time for interactive sessions.
We have three full mission bridges that can work interactively in the same exercise, meaning that, for example, one can be the ship, say an oil tanker, and then the two others can be tugboats, and we can put hawsers or lines between the tugboats and the ship and have an interactive exercise of tug escort maneuvers and certain maneuvers that are very difficult, dangerous, and expensive to perform in real life.
Inside the simulators is like a real experience at the helm. Computer programs change the view outside from day to night or from calm to choppy seas, and an operator has to meet maneuvering challenges to avoid obstacles. The simulators can also mimic conditions at all of the state's largest ports. Inside, Hamilton brings the ship to the Valdez oil terminal.
There's a bow thruster here, so we can actually work the ship sideways.
Hamilton says safety is the main focus of the training. The earliest round of classes will be attended by industry professionals to offer insights into the course, but after that, AvTech expects to be able to train about 60 pilots and captains a year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Talkeetna residents react to news that Denali isn't quite as tall as we thought.
Well, it's just going to be so much lower and so much easier for people to climb now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
Step into a remote fish camp. Listen to a Dena'ina love song composed in 1915. Those are a couple of the experiences Anchorage Museum visitors can expect when they tour the first comprehensive exhibit bringing together the language, history, and artifacts of the original inhabitants of South Central Alaska, the Dena'ina Athabascans. It opens Sunday at the Anchorage Museum. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has this preview.
One important theme of the exhibit is We're Still Here.
Most people who live in Anchorage have no idea that there is an indigenous population that has been here and continues to be here.
That's a perception that Aaron Leggett, one of the co-curators for the exhibit, wants to change.
My grandmother was a full-blooded Dena'ina Athabascan from the native village of Aklutna. Aklutna is the only federally recognized tribe within the municipality of Anchorage. So really, for my people, our traditional homeland is the Anchorage area.
Leggett has spent more than a half dozen years searching out the objects that appear in the exhibit, traveling mostly to museums across Europe. Most of the objects on display were collected in the 1700s and 1800s by explorers and museum collectors. Objects like an 8-foot-long beluga harpoon borrowed from Germany for the exhibit and a bowl made of doll sheep horn collected during the third voyage of Captain Cook in 1778 is on loan from the British Museum. Jim Fall is a cultural anthropologist who now manages subsistence programs for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's also a co-curator for the exhibit.
The name of the exhibition is Dena'ina Huch El Yeshi, which means the Dena'ina way of living.
Fall says pieces of Dena'ina history can be found right in the city. Point Warrensoff was a major fish camp in the early 20th century. Chester Creek was also an important fishing area. And there were several seasonal camps right in downtown Anchorage up until the 1930s. The Dena'ina were displaced leading up to World War II to make way for the growing city and military presence. The exhibit brings them back to life. It contains many interactive features, maps on iPads that allow visitors to explore traditional Dena'ina places around the city with their native names. A life-size recreation of a fish camp transports visitors to the southwestern frontier of Dena'ina territory near Non-Dalton. In the process of pulling the exhibit together, Fall has seen a lot of artifacts, but he thinks the most interesting ones in the exhibit are the quivers, which held hunters' arrows.
And these quivers, they're very beautiful objects, but they're also decorated with the images of various game animals that people hunted, as well as the hunters themselves. So they're fun to look at. They're beautiful, and they also tell us something, I think, about the respect that the hunters expressed to the animals that they depended on and hunted.
Hunters traveled across a vast, rich territory ranging from Seldovia in the south to Talkeetna in the north. Susie Jones is the deputy director of the museum and a co-curator for the exhibit. She says Dena'ina people are unique among Athabascans because they live both inland and along the salt water, and the exhibit demonstrates that.
One of the recreated settings in the exhibit is of a Dena'ina man hunting from a beluga-spearing platform. They upended a spruce tree, anchored it into the mud flat, and made a platform out of it with the root mass of the tree, and the hunter stood or sat there as beluga followed the salmon into the river mouth.
Today, Cook Inlet beluga whales are on the endangered species list, and Alaska Natives have voluntarily stopped hunting them because of declining numbers. In addition to artifacts and dioramas recreating traditional practices, the exhibit contains stories and songs. This song, composed by Dena'ina Shem Pete, was recorded in 1915. It's a lament to a lost love. A young man leaves his girlfriend and wonders if she's thinking about him as he walks the trail between Tyonek and Susitna Station. The song became well-known to Dena'ina singers throughout the 20th century. The exhibit for Leggett is his own love song to his people.
My hope is that when they grow up, they'll have something that they can turn to be proud of their heritage, because when I was a kid, we didn't really have a lot that we could point to that was definitively Dena'ina.
Leggett says the years of work he put into the exhibit are dedicated to his ancestors and to the next generation of Dena'ina. He helped edit a book to go along with the exhibit, which is the most comprehensive ever produced on the Dena'ina. The exhibit opens with a free celebration from 1 to 3 on Sunday, September 15th, and runs through January 12th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Less than 1% of Alaska's exports in 2012 ended up in the Philippines. But according to the island nation's first honorary consul to Alaska, new connections are being forged that could help build a market for Alaska seafood and even liquefied natural gas. Jeremy Shea from KTOO has the story.
If Alaska wants to make inroads in trade with the Philippines, the state has a lot of work to do. Here's the Philippines' recently appointed honorary consul to Alaska, Jenny Gomez Strickler.
When you say Alaska to folks in the Philippines, they don't think of the state, they think of milk. Apparently, Alaska is a brand of milk in the Philippines.
And if it's not milk?
It's a basketball. The basketball team that's sponsored by the milk company that's apparently fairly popular.
The Juneau resident and retired Alaska Department of Commerce and Economic Development worker was speaking to the Juneau World Affairs Council on Wednesday. In her new honorary role for the government of the Philippines, she's part bureaucrat and part international trade facilitator. She's trying to make the case that Alaska should mean seafood in the Philippines.
The Philippines is a fish-eating country, yet its fish is imported from other countries, and its imported salmon is farmed salmon.
Strickler, Juneau Representative Kathy Munoz, and the governor's office are trying to put together a seafood festival in Manila next year to show the country what Alaska has to offer. Strickler shared an anecdote about a missed connection that networking at the festival might fix. A former Juneau resident brought some Alaska seafood to Manila for his friends to try. One of the samplers happened to be a hotel owner.
The business owner enjoyed it so much, he said, "If I get this from you, can you guarantee me X amount throughout the year or portion of the year?" He looked him straight in the eye and said, "I can't because I'm not a fisherman."
She said they're working on a pitch to get support from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Strickler also said she was on a recent conference call between Philippine Ambassador Jose Quisha Jr. and state officials. The ambassador said he's putting together a team to visit Alaska and investigate opportunities to import liquefied natural gas. Finally, Strickler said Aklan State University in the Philippines is interested in sending instructors to the University of Alaska Southeast through an exchange program. They want to learn about saltwater fisheries. Strickler said she expects that arrangement to come together after the Juneau Assembly adopts a sister city proclamation linking Juneau and Calibo, the capital city of the Philippine province Aklan. A Juneau Assembly committee backed the proclamation on Monday. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly will consider a resolution tonight that seeks to prohibit the Environmental Protection Agency from retroactively revoking permits within the borough. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, resolution sponsors are responding to the EPA's decision this spring to revoke a permit for a controversial coal mining project in West Virginia.
In 2007, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers granted a permit to Arch Coal Incorporated for a West Virginia mountaintop coal mining project. The company used dynamite to blow the top off a mountain to reveal a coal seam below. In 2011, the Environmental Protection Agency cited concerns over water quality and revoked the permit. Arch Coal challenged the revocation in district court and won, but that decision was overturned by the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. last April. Assemblyman Carl Castle says he doesn't want to see similar action taken in the Fairbanks North Star borough.
We decided it was appropriate to, you know, make official comment because of the strength of the mining industry in Alaska and all the exploration they're doing and whatnot, that this is something that could potentially come into play in the future for us. And we felt that we should take a proactive approach to it to make sure that it doesn't happen here to the best of our ability.
Castle and presiding officer Diane Hutchison are sponsoring a resolution that asks the state congressional delegation and President Barack Obama not to allow the EPA to retroactively revoke development permits.
Once EPA makes a decision, I think they should be obligated to stick with the decision that they make and not retroactively go back and revoke a permit. That's really the topic here.
The resolution doesn't address the technical aspects of mining projects. Castle says he doesn't have any reason to believe the EPA plans to revoke current permits for local mining and development efforts. He says he hasn't yet contacted members of the congressional delegation about the resolution. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A collection of photographs by turn-of-the-century Denali explorer Belmore Brown is on display in Fairbanks. The exhibit at the Fairbanks Community Museum was put together by longtime Talkeetna climbing guide Brian Okanek, who describes Brown as a multi-talented pioneer.
He was quite a character, kind of a Renaissance man. He was an artist, a very, very good landscape painter. He was a naturalist, and he's also an explorer and climber. Attempted to climb Denali three times.
Brown's endeavors to the mountain included a trip to disprove Frederick Cook's 1906 first summit claim. Brown's 1912 expedition got within 300 feet of the top of Denali a year before a team led by Hudson Stuck logged the historic first summit. Okanek says he's long been fascinated by the early climbs and secured grants to travel to New Hampshire in 2012 to view Belmore Brown's archives at Dartmouth College.
Pretty exciting to walk into the library and have these shelves full of these boxes out of Belmore Brown's collection and just start going through them. It was like a treasure chest full of negatives and prints and then to be able to read through his journals.
Okanek says the vast majority of Brown's photos have not been published, and he was able to scan about 250 to bring back to Alaska. A selection of the pictures has toured the state, including this month's exhibit in Fairbanks. Okanek says researching pioneer Denali expeditions has given him great respect for the early climbers.
They were very, very trail-hardened. They put up with some incredible, incredible discomforts, whether it was the bugs and the rain and the bogs and the brush of getting there. And when Belmore Brown did it in 1912, their expedition was 7 months long from the time they left Seward till the time they finally got back to Skagway.
The news announcement yesterday that Denali is 83 feet shorter than previously believed came as a surprise to many Alaskans. You can count Talkeetna residents in that group, where the mountain's new height has a practical impact for the many people and businesses who depend on it. KTNA's Philip Manning spoke with a number of interested parties and has this report.
In Talkeetna, Denali is big business. Companies offer tours from the air, water, and land that promise visitors a chance at seeing the mountain that dominates the skyline. In addition, all of the climbers who attempt to summit Denali come through Talkeetna to register with the National Park Service. Any change involving the mountain is bound to have ripples in the community. While the change in elevation is significant, Denali Mountaineering Ranger Mark Westman says that it's not a case of the incredible shrinking mountain.
I would stress that, at least in terms of what I've been hearing, people have been referring to it saying the mountain shrunk. But for people who don't understand the whole thing, I think it would be important to emphasize that I'm pretty sure, just at first glance, that the mountain hasn't actually shrunk, but that the technology just got more precise.
Dave Johnston, a Talkeetna resident who has made a number of notable Denali climbs beginning in 1963, says that it's not unusual for mountains to have their elevations adjusted.
It's, to be expected as technology marches on,
go up a little, down a little. Maybe you could attribute it to global warming, but I don't think so.
Annie Duquette, who ran Denali's base camp for a decade, jokingly says that while the mountain is still the same, maybe the smaller number will have a psychological impact. Willie Pretty, reality television and mountaineering veteran, seems to agree, but also thinks that this opens the door to other changes.
Well, it's just going to be so much lower and so much easier for people to climb now. Yeah, I think it's time for a new elevation, new name. Get rid of this McKinley thing and go officially to Denali.
Beyond mountaineering, which is not likely to change much, there are issues of maps, documents, and literal tons of memorabilia that bears the 20,300-foot elevation figure. Lisa Roderick, current base camp manager on Denali, says that it's possible some of today's t-shirts, hats, and other items might be collectibles someday. For some businesses, the link to Denali's elevation goes well beyond merchandising. Jimmy Bush, a manager at the 2320 Alaskan Grill at McKinley Wilderness Lodge, says there are no immediate plans to change the restaurant's name, despite the new measurements. The 2320 Grill is not alone in maintaining the use of the accepted elevation figure. Alaskan Congressman Don Young says he doesn't plan to change how he refers to Denali.
This is something that it's the government says that I do. You believe the government? I'm not sure I do. So I'm going to leave the original height there of McKinley as it was. And until someone can show me any different, I'm going to say it's the height it was, and I'm going to advertise it as that.
Senator Lisa Murkowski takes a more diplomatic view.
You know, I'm never quite sure how they actually arrive at their numbers, but this is their proficiency. But I was a little distressed when I saw that.
In the end, Denali is still well ahead of Mount Logan, the second highest summit in North America, and is not likely to lose its crown anytime soon. In the meantime, anyone who owns memorabilia with the old elevation label has a limited time to sell it as a collector's item. If the National Park Service's estimates are true, Denali is growing and will hit 20,320 feet in about 36,000 years. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Seward, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.